Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
You're listening to Double Feature, a podcast sponsored by Massive Attack. That's right, we pair two films and then we talk about the band Massive Attack. And I apologize for 24 minutes or something. My name's Eric 13, I'm here with Michael Kester.
Hello.
Massive Attack has found its way on another fucking episode of Double Feature.
Yep.
That might happen a little later.
Got a giant assault of Massive Attack on Double Feature today.
This is going to be a very musical episode, I think.
Yeah, there's definitely something to it.
The something is the trick on today's episode of Double Feature. There's a thing that I feel like we should just probably talk about right away. So let's do the best intro we've ever done first.
All right, here we go. All right.
Okay. All right, I'm ready. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Do you want to start or should I?
I forgot what I already said. My name is Eric 13. I'm here with Michael Kester. This is Double Feature. Yeah, I ran out of stuff to say, so I think probably as far as I got.
If you have not listened to Double Feature before, hey, welcome. You are part of an exclusive group called Podmanity. If you want to know more about yourself, would you like to know more?
Do you want some more?
Go back to our very first episode of the year. That is Blade Runner and Fargo. That is a good spot to start because we're trying to keep everything concise and inside the arbitrary walls of a 52 episode streak that we have kept going 12 consecutive times.
Whoa, this is a lot of math. Yeah, this is starting to get math heavy, all this Double Feature. Well, you know what that does mean is you only have to watch, 13, 14 shows worth of films to be completely caught up.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I know.
There's no way that it's only 13 or 14. You're out of your mind.
Well, no, it's twice that. And then there's some species in there as well. Right.
But if you want to do some more math, you can do it financially by kicking a little bit of money into our Patreon. That's patreon.com/doublefeature. If you didn't want Get Carter or This Must Be the Place on the show, if you wanted literally any other film, if you go to the Patreon, you put a little dough in there, you can pick a film that we may cover. And if you don't believe me, wait till you hear what we're doing next time, because it's a film that we would not have covered if somebody didn't kick a little change in that Patreon. That's patreon.com/doublefeature. And that's just one of the things you can do. You can also have your name read weekly by Eric and probably pronounced correctly at least 50% of the time.
Maybe.
At the executive producer level.
We might have to switch to that 50-50 on the executive producers. I don't know at what point we decided to have the number of names and then say them every show, but that really upset 50% of the former executive producers who keep... I know I said, fucking years ago at this point that was an accident and we're going to fix it, and then I just never did. So keep your eyes peeled. There may be more executive producer slots. I know you guys love having your names read, and we like knowing who's chipping some money into the show. So that's pretty cool. This week, that is Patrick Klein, who wanted us to do This Must Be the Place.
Mm-hmm.
So we put it with Get Carter, and this is what I wanted to talk about here. Part of this is in my own desperate need to recontextualize This Must Be the Place.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you just look at the cover...
I know.
Some people don't have this problem. Look, we did Stranger Than Fiction. Last episode of the show, we talked about this a little bit. And some people look at the cover of Stranger Than Fiction and go, I'll watch that movie. Fine. And then some people, like yourself at the time, went, the cast of this movie, is this movie for me? I don't know. And they would have missed out. And they did miss out if they is you. And they needed to wait for Double Feature to catch them up. That's me, and This Must Be the Place. A movie that I looked at and I saw Sean Penn playing a character that looks like the lead singer of The Cure, Robert Smith. But it is not a movie about Robert Smith. And so I kind of wondered what the fuck's going on there. So there are some more fun ways to pair this. You and I had talked about the Gus Van Sant film
Mm-hmm.
Did we ever figure out what the fuck the name of that was? Or how to pronounce Zant? Zant? Gus, Gus Van Zant? Gus Van Zant. I'm trying to come up with every obvious improper pronunciation, but that's all I got.
Last Days?
Yeah, so I thought, you know, that's also a really good double feature because it's taking, you know, elements of reality, these iconic characters, and then doing something else with them. But even that movie is more, it's a little bit more the TV movie, we couldn't get the rights for this person, and we're going to skirt around it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like the Gus Van Sant movie, Elephant. Mm-hmm. There is a trilogy of these. Not what we're here to talk about. So I wanted to find some other movie we could do this with that would help pull at whatever else is going on in the movie so I wouldn't get locked up on this Robert Smith thing. But I do feel like we have to talk about it anyways, so that'll probably happen. You had your own kind of idea about the theme of this, mm-hmm. this show.
For me, I was trying to think of a way to incorporate sort of the latter half of the plot synopsis for This Must Be the Place, where a member of your family dies and you essentially have to go and make amends in some capacity, whether it's by your within your skill set or far without your skill set. You take upon the mantle of doing right by your dead relative and you step outside of your comfort zone.
So I think that, you know, we definitely have, this is the other thing that's weird about this. Let's get into this in the movie. Do we want to talk about Get Carter first or second?
I think second.
All right. It's official. We start with This Must Be the Place.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of making a nice segue to continue talking about that thing, I feel like I want to just fucking address the Robert Smith of it all.
Mm-hmm.
On the surface, because does this not bother you the way it bothers me?
I'll tell you the thing that's actually really interesting is let me put it this way. I had the Netflix This Must Be the Place in my queue, in my queue for a very long time, but I never watched it. I knew it was a thing I wanted to see, but something about that cover and this character's face made me go, I don't think I'm in the mood for it ever.
Yeah.
Which turned out to be amazing for me because once the movie starts, it's pretty quickly not that at all.
Yeah. I don't know what I wanted the film to.
I don't either.
Now again,
but it isn't that.
Once you see the film, none of the stuff matters.
Mm-hmm.
So really, this is not to talk about the body of the film at all. If your goal is just make a great film, tell a story, make some choices, all of that's accomplished. I'm just talking about the moments before I watch the film where I mm-hmm. look at the cover and I see Sean Penn and he's not playing a character that is Robert Smith.
Right.
And, you know, in that moment, I don't know if I'm more or less happy if this is a movie where he is Robert mm-hmm. Smith or if that's really a thing I even want or why I'm craving that. So there's just this weird block. I think the reason is I feel like it's co-opting a part of culture or something.
But I think that's intentional. I think that one of the most important things with this story is to illustrate this character as quickly as it can within the world. And I think if it goes kind of like this and you see him, you see where he exists in society, it's pretty easy for you to fill in a lot of the blanks that the movie doesn't have time or interest in doing. Because it's super important that you get what type of guy this is and what type of music he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the fact that it does sort of co-opt Robert Smith as an image really allows for that impactful moment where he goes, some kids killed themselves because I made sad songs.
Yeah, you get that right away.
You get it.
Sure.
Right? And if he looked like Sean Penn or he looked like a post new wave, you know, musician, if he looked like you know, James Taylor, if he looked like any other musician who was a little less explicitly visually that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's only a few genres in history that you can look at you can look at a member of the band and go 70s punk rock, sure, 80s hair metal, sure, 80s yeah, new wave. And I think their decision to do that with the character allows you to fill in so many blanks that the movie isn't even necessarily interested in covering, but acknowledges the need to create that depth. But it is, it's amazing because it's a super useful tool that makes that image is a tough pill until you understand the cocktail.
Well, that's what's interesting about this to me, is that my brain had so much trouble with it. Mm-hmm. Not that I think it's a bad decision or wrong or that I wanted anything else, but that there was some resistance as a person who really likes The Cure and likes dark wave music and post-punk and all of that, that there's some kind of weird fucking resistance in me to, you know, just feeling like someone's stealing from my culture or something, mm-hmm, you know, that feels. Mm-hmm. But then actually watching it, that exact problem, first of all, in order to win that argument, all you have to do is not be co-opting culture, which it isn't, so it wins anyways. But it's actually doing something that I found remarkably cool, which is that this character is a blend of a lot of those bands.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, visually, Robert Smith has such a iconic fucking look, and the fact that he continues it into, you know, the age he is what makes this character so easily identifiable. But also their band name is basically Susie and the Banshees.
Right.
Right. It's like Cheyenne and the Fellows or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is totally what that is. And nobody, you know, even the looking at the word Susie and how it's spelled and the word Cheyenne and how it's spelled, they both just have like, they're way too long for the amounts, mm-hmm, of sounds that your mouth makes.
Yeah.
And then all the stuff with David Bryan and the Talking Heads.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And, you know, basing the title out of it and using the music and then the actual like David Bryan performance, mm-hmm, piece in it. The music video to rival episode 8's of The Return.
Yeah.
Or what was the, Body Double. Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
the other movie that we talked about that just has, okay, I want to do a Talking Heads performance here. So I'm just going to, we're going to hang out here and, mm-hmm, and do that.
But I think that's super, the integration of that scene where he says, you're an artist and I just did what was popular, is vastly important to inform this character's need to do something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I feel like when you get to the latter throes of the movie and you start, you know, you start incorporating the whole, I'm going to go kill a Nazi thing, which weird, but also in 2019, way less weird. But at the time of this movie, weird. I think the fact that he has that conversation with David Byrne and goes, you're an artist and I'm just a puppet.
Mm.
And it essentially informs, not that it is a secret, but it informs the fact that he has never been fulfilled by fucking anything.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not fulfilled by his marriage. His pool is literally not fulfilled. He is,
right.
He is an entirely unfulfilled shell of a person who has managed to succeed despite fulfillment.
Mm.
And it has worked for him and it's comfortable and it's easy. And so he doesn't make any waves, but all of a sudden he just goes, I need to actually amount to literally anything.
Well, and another thing that isn't, you know, a common thread with these bands,
mm-hmm,
you know what I mean? So it really is kind of imagining, it's not like it's taking the sum total of all of these other bands and creating a figure out of it,
mm-hmm,
because they were really driven. You know, if you want to talk about like vapid music in the 80s, I don't want to blame Frankie Goes to Hollywood, but that genre, mm-hmm, like Relax is clearly doing its own fucking thing. But there was a lot of stuff in more of the new wave and less of the upbeat stuff, you know,
mm-hmm,
the stuff at fucking clubs that, the Duran Duran songs,
yeah,
that were happy and not sad. Although they got fucking songs too. So I don't know. I'm trying to find a target in the 80s that I can pick on that I won't feel bad about.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's got to be dead, right? Somebody? All right. Well, whatever. There was plenty of music in the 80s that was, people were just doing it because it sold.
Right.
You know, like all of pop music. So,
sure.
But The Cure is certainly not something you're pointing at or any of the music you're playing tribute to. So to have that be a central part of his character is also another interesting choice, because then that goes on to guide where he is in his life now.
Mm-hmm.
That he's you know, the synopsis of this movie uses the word bored a lot,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
I thought was really strange. You don't see a lot of movies advertise themselves as starring a character who's bored. So they go on a trip. It just seems like such a, you know, really put that twist early in your description there, put that heavy.
I think this character is, I mean, as a central component of the movie, but also just in cinema at large, I've just never seen this person on the screen before.
Mm.
There are moments that are just, I don't know if it's from a performance standpoint or by design of the film before it was in Sean Penn's hands.
Mm.
But there are just moments where this character does and says things that just nobody would do if they ever existed in normalcy. But he has essentially managed to skirt being a normal person his entire life.
Mm.
And I just think like back to the moments where he finds out that, I can't remember it. What is the name of the new band? The Really Shits or something like that?
Yeah.
the total shit or whatever.
Uh-huh.
They're just like, the name of the band is We're Bad.
Man, if that character had shown up just 2 weeks earlier, this would be mm-hmm. a movie about producing his album
mm-hmm.
to stave off the boredom.
Mm-hmm.
Just bad timing on his part.
But I love the reaction to that, which is like this long pause where you think, oh my God, he's about to be off the boat. And he just goes, that's really fucking good.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because I can't tell if the movie is going, he's an idiot, or if the movie is going, he's really like on, like he really gets the climate of music. Because I think in 2019, that a band called The Rotten Shits, probably a really good band name.
I love your various takes on this. You're workshopping it here.
Yeah, here live on the show. Good. I can't remember which one feels good.
Right.
And I think in 2019 that's a great idea, because essentially you have to come out the gate. Remember, did you ever hear about this band called The Slants?
I don't think so.
Punk rock band from Pacific Northwest. It's amazing from a litigation standpoint because they won a free speech suit. It's an all Asian punk band.
Oh, I did hear
about
this.
An all Asian punk band, and they're calling themselves The Slants, which is a derogatory term for their race, but they are taking ownership of it because they are all in fact Asian and they won a free speech suit. But I feel like that is essentially where this band in the movie is kind of aiming their name. And so for his character to go, oh yeah, that's fucking dope, makes me go, he's not totally devoid of artistic understanding.
Yeah.
He just doesn't care that much.
Right, right. When he needs to bust out an Arcade Fire cover, he's on.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that fucking exchange kills me. And just like, obviously the right choice to have the kid sing it. It's mm-hmm. super funny. So let's come back to that that thing that all the listeners thought I forgot about, which we initially started talking about, which was the plot of this road journey here. I want to say something totally fucking crazy, and then I want you to tell me if you relate, disagree, or don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. That'll be the game we play here. So in this movie, there is, I feel like, a progression of time and movement between plot points or even scenes. I feel like the way the movie is, it's not even how it's cut, it's the story. The way the movie's story goes on, when we show up in a scene, I often get the feeling that we've just arrived there. And a lot of the A to B work of actually navigating our way through the plot, there's sort of a mystery here. We got to hunt down this guy, and we're going across the country hunting him down. So if I just started writing down the scenes that I think you would see in a movie like that, there'd be a lot of time exchanging information and figuring out what it means and then making sure the audience knows what it means and mm-hmm. then journeying to the different locations. But instead, I feel like we always just kind of show up in locations and I have to catch up with how the fuck we got there.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that there is a certain, as if you've come here and you have no say in it. You wind up in a diner and you weren't even there sitting in the car driving, making the conscious choice. It's as if life has just thrust you into this diner now and you're doing this part. And then you find yourself in a hotel room and then you're doing that part. As if the kind of events that are happening in the world feel utterly out of your control. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I mean, I think
you've seen a lot of road trip movies.
Uh-huh.
You usually spend some time getting to the different places and kind of knowing where you're going, right? I feel like very spun around.
But I think that is also indicative of this character's status, because here's I think the piece missing from this movie that the other movies, you know, your classic road trip movies. I'm just thinking in my mind, like Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, right?
Mm-hmm. The classic ones everyone knows. Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. You couldn't at least go Easy Rider there, huh?
No. Easy Rider is not what I want. It's that this character is so affluent.
Mm-hmm.
They're so post themselves. You know, this isn't the interesting leg of this person's life. That's the important thing about this movie. A movie about this guy should have been about his music career ending with those suicides.
Yeah,
this is a movie post that. This is post this person. This would be like a movie about Betty White that took place starting in 2015.
Yeah, right.
It's just not the movie you care about, but it's the movie you're given.
That was a little bit of my thinking on Last Days too, was like a little too on the nose for a double feature.
Yeah. And it's sort of this character's affluence is such that he goes, I'm bored. I'm going to go hunt a Nazi. And then he's there because what's going to stop him? It's not the paycheck.
Sure,
you know, he's going to take a first class flight to kill a Nazi world.
Yeah.
You know,
it's not about the trials and tribulations you find on the road and the uphill battle
No, not at all. He's essentially one step away from just calling up the hostel and going, got any Nazis?
Right. That's right.
And they go, we do have one Nazi. And he's like, put him on hold. I'll be right there.
Yeah. Well, it's also great because it works hand in hand with exploring, you know, if this is a character study, part of who this character is very childlike.
Yeah.
You know, is very, there's kind of that, I mean, it works the same way somebody who is on a road trip and doesn't have a lot to say about that destination, you know, that's a very childlike way of viewing things.
Mm-hmm.
So things just sort of seem, one, you have no hurdles, and two, it sort of seems out of your control once you've made the decision to do it then. Because if you have a bunch of hurdles, then when times get tough, you really take a moment to soul search and go, oh, do I really want to be on this road trip? Mm-hmm. I don't know if I should do it. I need to summon some courage or go through some events that really makes me double down. And because his character doesn't have those types of hurdles, then there is, you know, the point of no return for him is basically once he decides he's going to go do this. That's basically mm-hmm. it, because then mm-hmm. there isn't any pushback. And so from that moment on, the train is already on the tracks, you know, the
right.
movie's on the rails, and there's really nothing to say about it. And then Get Carter.
Well, Get Carter is essentially the exact opposite of that, right? Because Get Carter is about a guy who goes, all right, well, I'm going to go avenge my brother. And first of all, a bunch of people go, don't. And he's like, I'm definitely gonna.
Yeah.
And then he is consistently met with roadblocks, but he is also a professional roadblock breaker
mm-hmm.
in this arena. It's essentially exactly the opposite, where he's a where in the previous movie, this is about somebody who, I don't know. I mean, it's not explicitly stated, but probably hasn't killed any Nazis.
Right.
And then this is a movie about a guy who he's essentially just like, eh, I guess I'm going to go back to work, even though I'm retired.
Well, that's part of the DNA of it too, is it's full of crime. It's full of, it's dirty streets for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm trying to think of what the timeline is in terms of how the other films, you know, this is early 70s, 71 or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels to me to be very influential of when we started to get to movies like Death Wish.
Right.
Right. Or eventually.
Or Harry Brown.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I feel like people don't talk about Get Carter next to Harry Brown nearly enough. But, you know, when Harry Brown was coming out, everyone was going, oh, I see what you're doing here. You're doing like a Death Wish thing. And no one's going like, hey, Michael Caine, this is sort of like your early films.
Yeah. It's like Old Man Get Carter.
Right. Totally.
Get Old Grandpa Man Carter. Get
Carter. God. Can I give you a list of things you learn about Get Carter from a Hollywood party? Highly informative. I told some people I was doing this the other night, and the reactions that I got were not about Harry Brown or Old Man Get Carter. They were, first of all, I learned that there's a 2000 remake starring Sylvester Stallone. Was not aware of that at all. In fact, I
knew that.
I almost had a moment of panic because I went, this is the kind of thing Michael would put on the show and not tell me about. And then I would have watched the wrong Get Carter. Super, super odd. Also, someone thought we should pair it with John Carter of Mars. So just so you know, that was out there too.
Sure.
And leave it to the professionals, guys. Leave it to the professionals. So this is a time back in the 70s where movies weren't coming out like this that felt so seedy.
Right.
You know, that felt really as full of, it's another thing that it's hard now and it gets fucking harder with every decade to know this. But when you look at cinema, you know, coming out overseas, certainly at the time, you don't get nearly as much of this kind of crime. And we're used to now, you know, we've been through decades of fucking James Bond. So it doesn't seem nearly as, and over here, blaxploitation too, right?
Totally. Yeah.
Coffee and Foxy Brown seem like America's taken its, you know, its take on this, but we've got these films that came out of this, like when we did the Limey on the show. I know this was a big film for Soderbergh, and I think it was a Tarantino movie too.
Yeah.
Get Carter needs to, people need to go back to their Jackie Brown write-ups, and I think they need to stick a little Get Carter in there because I feel like this is a new Beverly film for sure. Were you shocked when you watched this at the violence or the lack of violence compared to your modern eyes?
Definitely the latter. The latter. Yeah.
yeah, it's hard, right?
It's amazing because I look at the synopsis of this movie and I'm like, oh man, this is gonna be a fucking river of blood.
And when you meet people who saw it in 1971 or whatever, they tell you about it like it's the grittiest fucking thing you've ever seen.
There's just gonna be a wake of bodies behind this guy.
Yeah.
And then you watch the movie and of course it's not, because it's exacting expertise in the crime. It's essentially the Michael Mann version of, you know, a criminal detective movie. It's just somebody who's like, well, how are you going to find your, you know, your dead brother's killer? Nobody's going to tell you.
Yeah.
And it's not like you can kill your way to the answer.
Yeah. Well, I think there are still scenes in it that ring out really iconic and do fit very well. And like, I think you could cut a trailer of it that probably looked like that movie today.
Oh my God, yeah. Totally.
Out of the scenes. Or especially, you know, just some of the, I think about the shot of Carter on the, you know, the front stoop of the flat naked with the double barrel shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just such a, it just looks like a fucking shovel. The thing is huge standing there. And then what is it? It's like a marching band that goes by or something.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the scene to show, to be like, yeah, look at this film getting down and dirty. You've never seen anything like this in cinema before. Also part of a weird subgenre.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you could think of any of these films off the top of your head. but there was just a time that we need to return to when the way that you solve that mystery of how to find your dead whatever or the person who killed the so-and-so or kidnapped the whoever this is was to watch a projection of a pornographic film in someone's home.
Sure, sure.
Someone needs to build this list. I will contribute Lost Highway to this as well.
Well, it's definitely, there's an homage paid to it in The New Guys too.
That was definitely another one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like a noir thing. I kind of feel like LA Confidential sort of had something like this.
Probably.
You know, there was...
Yeah.
What was it in that movie? It was call girls made up to look like adult actresses, mm-hmm. I believe is the noir language they use that even feels kind of gross to say. Mm-hmm. Dames made up to look like Hollywood movie stars. Fucking gross, the 1950s. The thing I wanted to talk about with the music, and you know, you can just reach out the cane with the hook to drag me off the stage here if we get...
Yeah, you can't say cane like that.
Damn it. I've gone like 3 episodes without making an accidental pun, but what are you going to do? So... what episode were we talking about Massive Attack on? I feel like we were
We were talking about Gigantic Assault in Species 4.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Which also fittingly, on the Species episode of the show, when we mentioned photos of mm-hmm. you is modeled after pictures of you, and pictures of you is from The Cure.
Oh my God.
Once again, proving not that it all ties together, but that you and I only think of maybe 3 things in the world. And that's the sum total of our interests. And so Massive Attack is back on the fucking show. But I wasn't even thinking just Massive Attack, but Portishead too. There was this era of trip hop that you and I came to kind of late.
Yeah.
This is how I saw Get Carter. This is oddly for this movie, my second time seeing Get Carter. If you met me, you would not assume I'm the type of person who just watches Get Carter all the time, but I have seen this movie twice. Mm. The first time was because the soundtrack, or I guess I should say the score, was so influential to this 90s and the era just beyond that of trip hop. These guys all fucking talk about this stuff in interviews. And especially I remember Portishead talking about it. I can't remember if it was samples or not. So I kind of need to cite my sources on that, I think. But the score was known for being, I think it was a jazz trio. This is all stuff I'm remembering from, you know, 10 fucking years ago. So
You're reaching deep.
Yeah. Do your own DuckDuckGoes on this business here. But the score was made for some incredibly low amount of money, $500 or whatever. And it's like 3 guys doing this really quick and dirty. It's not even a jazz score. The reason the score is so weird is because they were approaching it the way a filmmaker does, a sort of Rodriguez style. How do I get the most production value for this little mm-hmm. bit that I have? So they're making this movie that's supposed to be very grand and capers, and it feels somewhere half between a quick and dirty movie and a giant explosive movie. So you can start to see why the Soderbergh shows up, right? That's like exactly where Soderbergh is, making giant crime caper movies on smaller budgets. So what the musicians did for the score was they took these very limited resources they had and they used them in all these weird ways to try to make it sound like they had way more instruments and just way more stuff in order to make this score. So out of the sheer necessity of trying to sound as grand as they could, they mixed all this weird stuff that you wouldn't think goes together tonally. These instruments that were, I mean, I guess part of it is tricks where you're using a lot of effects or like very big reverb all over everything, because if you just warp the fucking reverb into oblivion, you can get some pretty crazy sounds.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also mixing these like South African drums or this, or maybe it's like Latin drum percussion set, because basically whatever they had in this studio, they're like, have we used this instrument yet? Have we used this instrument?
I'm familiar with that.
Just put all of this in here. Yeah, right. So you start to get this mix that is whatever's around, and then what settings have we not tweaked these knobs to previously? Mm-hmm. Like, let's try turning this one down and this one way up, and it'll make it sound like we have all this stuff. And so, for whatever reason, this was one of the scores that, you know, trip hop was doing this weird thing where they were going back to a lot of movie scores, even though it wasn't very sample based. It was still, let's get our inspiration for how to create the sounds based off of what was happening with scores at the time. Not even necessarily repeating the methods. I just feel like they were listening to a lot of the score going, oh, this is cool, and then taking little distinct bits. It turns out in that giant amalgam of crazy noises that they landed on a few things that maybe no one would have ever tried ever.
Right.
And trip hop people were going, oh, that's the sound we should make trip hop out of. Like, that's the, there's one in here that I don't know if it's an actual, hopefully somebody knows something about this. They can write us. It's Double Feature Show at iCloud.com. Do you remember that first Gorillaz album kind of came out in that era, right? Where it's like a little
I think it was 2000 something.
Yeah, it was early 2000s, right? So it's like when the trip hop is sort of hitting another wave of where it's turning into like bittersweet and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's getting a little like big band and a little more commercial, a little more poppy. But Gorillaz had this song. I know I've talked about this on the show before because it disappeared, but it was called Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good track, and for some reason it's like not on a lot of the digital versions, and maybe this is why, but I could swear that the weird little instruments doing the high melody on that song on Dracula sounds like the end credits.
Yeah.
To the right after the shot end credits of this movie. So we're so in the weeds that no one will know, but if one person out there knows, it will solve this lingering mystery in my head that otherwise I'll only be able to figure out by watching some projected pornography in someone's home theater system somewhere. I think that's how you get to the bottom of that. The ending is the one thing that I think still feels today like, whoa.
The very ending or the very long chase scene?
Well, the very ending. The sort of like, pow, movie's over.
Mm-hmm.
Pow, nothing you can do about it. Movie's over.
Well, that's something, if you want to talk about, and spoiler alert, earmuffs, if you want to talk about something that has transcended into modern cinema, and I'm not going to name it, but you know my recent history enough for me to just say this and you'll know what I'm talking about, and that's all I care about.
Uh-huh.
There is definitely a modern film series that employs that exact thing.
Uh-huh.
And this is a film series that has an ongoing amount of sequels, nearly say a Killapalooza number of sequels. All
right. That's enough out of you.
That employs that sort of cold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's beautiful because it seems almost like, oh my God, you went through all that work and that's all you're going to do.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is essentially this punctuation that goes, I know I went through a lot of work. It's to do a thing. And I'm not going to sit here and pontificate and go, you know, before I kill you.
Yeah, right.
It's just like, hey, fuck you. You're a fucking creature. Like I've no interest in leveling with you. I don't want to appeal to your humanity. I just want you dead. I just want you to no longer exist.
Well, that's one of the things that does play differently depending on when you watch Death Wish, is there's this morality or maybe immorality that I feel like depends on what's going on in society at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get to the end of the movie and it does seem like, okay, dispensing with the monsters, you know, you could look at this movie and think, I mean, maybe this is true of any vigilante movie, but when somebody is taking the law into their own hands and just going out and, you know, threatening in the street, there are certain times in society when that feels like, I don't totally know why this is. Certain times when that seems like we should be doing this.
Sure.
And other times when it's just like, this is wrong. And I can't believe somebody made a movie promoting these values. You know, it's just this really conservative is certainly not the right word. But yeah, there's a vigilante justice thing. I think that's what it is that makes this sometimes feel like it's a dark, smutty kind of story.
Yeah. I mean,
and sometimes
I think
it's like the way things should be.
I think it's not vigilante justice to me feels a little bit too moral high ground for what Carter is trying to pull off in this movie. For me, it just feels like vengeance as a sentence. You know what I mean? It's sort of about the litigation of purely revenge. It's fascinating to me because he's essentially going, you did a bad thing, you will die for it.
Yeah.
And in the context of watching the film, part of you wants to be like, fuck yeah. But a bigger part of you goes, you shouldn't be killing people. If you're me.
Right. Michael always has this internal.
But I think it's interesting because there is in the United States. Cool. I'm getting to this right at a good spot because we don't have to dwell. We can just bail. But there's an interesting thing in the United States where we go, you did a bad thing, we're going to kill you about it. Mm-hmm. And everybody's like, justice. But in Get Carter, he's got to like go through all these hoops just to do the thing that like if his brother got murdered in like Oklahoma, he wouldn't even have to like leave home.
Right. Well, I also think that when we look at this as a movie that influences Death Wish, I mean, Death Wish had the same fucking problem, right? Because it's like there's a certain period of time. Maybe it's because people feel disenfranchised with the law.
You're talking Bronson Death Wish, not Willis Death Wish.
Well, think about that. You know, people wouldn't even try Willis Death Wish because, man, did that come out at the right or the wrong time. The right time to be fundamentally or unequivocally ignored by everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of if the movie was good or not, people wouldn't even try it out. Because it was just, you know, in the United States, it was at the height of gun crime. So people were having a debate in public about, or in, I don't know what you'd call it, in politics and popular conversation. There's a debate going on, should we arm teachers? And then Death Wish comes out. People were not wanting to have that conversation in the cinemas coming Christmas 2017 or whenever the fuck that movie was. It was just not the time. So I think, you know, whether it's weird how the society then goes back and informs the film in some way, because whether the film ends up being about morality or immorality or taking morality into your own hands is totally up to the audience's shading. You know, you could really look at the film as a proponent of a number of different degrees of that, just kind of based on what's happening out in the world at the time. And so you see that too, I think, in the influences, in the different parts of, look at the influences we talked about. If it's, you know, either version of Death Wish or the remake, or the fucking Limey, or Jackie Brown. If Jackie Brown's taking elements of this movie, it's doing it to empower characters who are down and out. It's this whole variety of different kind of moral tales that all come out of this one place in 1971. Look at the time. Let's get out of here. I want to thank the executive producers of this show slowly. Over the course of 1,000 years, Charles Freck thanked the executive producer Tom Leonard, Bruno Hunziker, Ben Ecker, John, Brett Hayton, Billy Wilson, Charles Crawford, and Abbot of Unreason. If you would like the internet speeds around here to be a little faster so we could get to the executive producer sooner, you can sign up on patreon.com/double feature and keep the show live. Big thanks to everybody who did that. And big transition to Michael, who knows the movies we're doing next time on the show.
Can we thank, you know, what's his name for the Robert Smith movie again?
Oh my God. Of course we can. That is Patrick Kline.
Patrick Kline. That's right.
For This Must Be the Place. And Patrick seems like he would like Get Carter. So I don't know. We'll find out.
We'll find out. Oh, I'm sure we'll find out.
People watch the other movie, the so-called sure. B-movie when we pair their... They have to, right?
Yeah.
There's right. no Patrick way Klein, that Patrick's
Patrick
like,
Klein
oh, I'm
was
not
the
watching.
Amy Adams to our Gyllenhaal pair.
All right. Very good. Very good. It's all tight. We've really got tight ties. If you could just make an Eden Lake reference at some point today, sure. I'll hit right. Invaders from Mars and we'll have the whole thing figured out.
Next time on Double Feature, we're going to do something previously unheard of in podcast history. This podcast this year, I mean. We're going to do a double documentary, double feature, double clip.
I have to say, I'm not even prepared for the fact we're doing this.
This is a really good double feature. I'm super excited. And I'm going to name the order we're going to do it in. And because I'm the only one who's seen both movies, you don't get to argue with me.
All right.
So we're going to do one documentary called Tickled. I'm not going to tell you what it's about. Just watch it. And then we're going to do another documentary called Graphic Sexual Horror, which I don't need to tell you what it's about because it's called that.
It just also sounds so wonderful to go, what's next week on your podcast? Oh, Tickled and Graphic Sexual Horror.
Yeah.
Which could basically be the theme for any of the other shows, but that's that is true. The actual titles of yeah. the movie next time. We're just exposing how we do double feature here. We're
right.
we're lifting back the curtain. We're looking for Tickled and Graphic Sexual Horror.
That's another listener pick too. I'm not going to tell you which one, but it's the one you think it is. So until then, watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.